This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. On May 27, 1977, an uprising within Angola's ruling party, the MPLA, turned into a national massacre. It left an unknown number of Angolans dead. Hundreds, thousands, nobody knows for sure. Laura Pawson learned of that massacre as a BBC correspondent in Angola, and she says the trauma still affects Angolans today. And very few want to talk about it. She wrote a book, In the Name of the People, Angola's Forgotten Massacre. She's in North Carolina for a talk today. She'll be back October 16th for another talk at Duke. Laura Pawson is with us now. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I feel very honored, really. Thank you very much.
It is a great pleasure to have you here and talk about this thing. I mean, again, you know, if you say 1977 and Angola and MPLA, you can imagine listeners out there saying, oh, my goodness, how could this have anything less to do with me? And yet this is very, very closely linked to American history.
Yeah.
We should talk maybe about Angola and its civil war, which became a proxy war in the Cold War, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So Angola got independence in 1975 from Portuguese. So it had been a Portuguese colony. And the war that came, I mean, it didn't actually come just after independence. It had begun really before independence,
right,
because Angola had three liberation movements. Unlike a lot of these countries, it had the national liberation was divided between three movements. Two of those movements were supported to a greater or lesser extent by the United States and also by South Africa's then apartheid regime.
Right.
And the other movement, the MPLA, the ruling party, was supported by the Soviet Unions and Cuba. I mean, there were problems within those relationships, but simply put, that was the division. And so when independence came, very quickly the country collapsed in a way between or divided between these, on the one hand, a rebel movement supported by ostensibly the right, and a movement supported by the left. And that war continued right up until 2002, 27 years. So, I mean, it was one of the longest civil wars in Africa.
And again, Angola was a little bit late to the liberation movement. And you're talking about 1975.
Yeah, indeed.
Many of the liberations took place in the early 60s.
Indeed,
right?
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, the Portuguese, well, then we get into kind of Portuguese history, which is something I began to understand as I worked on the book, that the Portugal had a dictatorship under Salazar,
right.
General Salazar. And he had been in power for roughly 50 years, half a century. So when Portugal kind of officially became a sort of official colonizer of Angola in the beginning of the 20th century, the Angola was dominated by a Portuguese dictatorship, but so were the Portuguese. They were also living under a dictatorship. And Angola's liberation occurred because of the fall of Salazar. So there was a coup in Portugal in 74, which some listeners may know about, is called the Carnation Revolution. And that revolution in Portugal led to the collapse and the end of colonialism in Angola. So the two countries are so closely linked, you really can't overstate that.
Well, let's talk about the indigenous movements then. You talked about basically three liberation movements all sort of preparing for the moment when finally Angolans could regain control of their country. I should say regain. That's nonsense. Angola is it's a fiction created by Europeans. But now there will be this country, Angola, and there'll be a native population there, and they'll have control. What are these liberation movements about? And again, it's complicated because already the Americans and Soviets, it's part of a geopolitical, a larger game. But what internally, what were those movements about and who did they represent?
Okay. Well, I mean, it's a huge question. Can I just say one thing before we go off on there? Angola was one of the first, or the region that today is Angola, was one of the first parts of Africa to come into contact with the Europeans. The Europeans arrived there in the 1480s. So, you know, 500 years of European contact. The three liberation movements, initially there was two. Okay, there was the MPLA, which we're going to focus on, the left-wing Marxist movement. That was basically coming out of Luanda, which is the capital, which is on the coast. And that movement was led by Angolans and also white Angolans, so Portuguese people who were the sons and daughters of Portuguese migrants, and also people who were in Angola known as mestiços, so people who were the children of often a white father and a black mother. And it was a very urban movement. It was a very, in many ways, quite a European movement. A lot of the leaders spoke Portuguese, they spoke French, and most of them had been educated in Europe. So to some extent, that movement is, crudely put, is very closely linked to sort of European history itself. And many of the people who led it were people who didn't speak indigenous languages, okay? So it was an urban, elite-educated movement. Then you had the FNLA, which was in the north of the country, very close to Congo, Congo of Zaire, so President Mobutu. Well-known president, lots of people have heard of him. And that was that movement, the FNLA, was led by a guy called Holden Roberto, who was the brother-in-law of Mobutu. And it was a movement that was almost entirely dominated by the Bakongo, the people of Congolese Bakongo ethnicity.
Very little European influence.
Absolutely.
In that group.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it was much more of a sort of seen as a much more Africanist, right. Black Africanist movement. Now, the third movement, UNITA, which I suspect a lot of American listeners may have heard of because the leader of UNITA, Jonas Savimbi, had very close connections with the Americans, that actually came out, that was a breakaway movement from the FNLA. So Jonas Savimbi had initially been part of the FNLA, and then he set up UNITA. And UNITA came to be associated with peoples of the south of Angola, so the central highland cities of Huambo and Quito and further south.
So if I'm in Angola and I am desperate to become separate and finally independent from the Portuguese, my choices are these Africanist movements, but now there's a real racial overlay because, as you say, the avowedly Marxist-Leninist group, the MPLA, who ultimately comes to power, is associated with Europe and essentially the white party. I'm overstating it here. Right.
Well,
but
yes,
but there's a racial overlay. Here.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, in some ways, you're not overstating it because the MPLA. I mean, this is where Angolan politics starts to become really confusing, and I still find it confusing, and so do quite a lot of Angolans.
Sure.
But the MPLA, like a lot of political parties, I'm sure the same with the Democrats and the Republicans, was a party, a movement that was split. So there were divisions within this movement. So there was a section of the party which was very much dominated by whites and mestizos, absolutely as you said. Then there was another section that was dominated more by people it was led actually by a guy from the east of the country. So it was seen as a more kind of Africanist movement. And then there was another movement that was dominated by a particular strand of people from within Luanda. So it was actually divided to some extent racially, also ethnically. So races, I mean, let me put it this way. When I was researching this book, the subject of the 27th of May and this massacre, which is a taboo in Angola, one of the things I felt that I learnt was that race is also a taboo in Angola. It's a subject that people don't like to talk about. But once you get into the slum areas of Luanda and into the poorer areas, everybody talks about it. And it came up again and again and again in my book, The Subject of Race, to the extent that I began to think that Angola in some ways has more in common with South Africa than it may do with, say, somewhere like Congo Kinshasa. You know, it's a really racially divided country.
In which, as you say, people don't like to talk about it or this massacre. Now take us to May 27th, 1977.
Okay, so the 27th of May, 1977, at dawn, that morning in Luanda, people were woken up to gunshots. And very quickly, it appeared that there was a coup, an attempted coup taking place. That statement I've just made about a coup, people are divided about whether that happened or not. But certain things definitely happened. The national radio station was overtaken by loyalist supporters of a man called Nito Alvish. And he was the leader of the uprising, and he had been the Minister of Interior. And he was a young black Angolan, a radical young black Angolan, who was fed up with the domination within the MPLA of mestizos, whites. And also, he said that Agostinho Neto, who was the black leader of the MPLA, President Neto, was not radical enough and wasn't forcing, imposing change. And he talked about that along lines of race. Now, on the day of the 27th of May, the national radio station was overtaken for a few hours by these guys. They also broke into the central prison in Luanda and released political prisoners and encouraged them to come out on the streets. Some of them did, some of them didn't. And they also, there was a brigade of the army involved in this. So in my reading, it's very hard to say that this wasn't an attempted coup. I mean, you don't take over the national radio station, liberate, in inverted commas, a prison, and get part of the army involved if you're not trying to force something militarily. However, there were Cuban soldiers, thousands of Cuban soldiers, tens of thousands of Cuban soldiers in Angola at the time, and they were there defending the MPLA from the US-backed UNITA rebels. And these Cuban soldiers were deployed to end and put a stop to the uprising. And that was when the killing started. And they took control back of the radio station. In fact, one of the first people to come onto the radio waves at about lunchtime on the 27th of May was a Cuban general saying, you know, everything's calm, we're back in control. And Cuban tanks went out into the Musek, the slums of Luanda, and overran people's homes and arrested lots of people and also killed quite a lot of people.
Yeah, we don't know how many.
Well, no, we
what
don't.
What are the various estimates and who's saying what?
Yeah, good question. So one of the people I interviewed for my book, who has now sadly passed away, was a man who called Ndunduma, who was the editor of the state newspaper, a powerful man within the MPLA, a white man within the MPLA. And he says that only, in inverted commas, only 500 people were killed. But there are some people, including, for example, William Tone, another very esteemed journalist in Angola, quite a radical guy, but whose family comes from within the MPLA. So he himself is linked very closely to the MPLA. And William Tone says it's about 80,000.
Well, the dispute itself shows indicates that this is a poorly researched right. I mean, in other words, nobody was interested, or people in power were not interested in getting to the bottom of it. They were interested in getting over it pretty quickly. That's a pretty good indication if you don't have numbers and that kind of a disparity. So what is the reluctance? The fact is it failed. It only lasted for a very short time, and yet you say the impact is still felt in Angola.
Yeah. I mean, the extraordinary thing is, you know, I'm now in my late 40s. I studied African politics at SOAS, at the School of Oriental and African Studies. It's a very respected college in London. I did a degree and then I did a master's. I studied Southern African politics. I worked on material around Angola. And when I went to live in Angola as a journalist, the first I ever heard of the 27th of May was from an Angolan colleague, an Angolan journalist. I'd never heard it mentioned before. And when this Angolan colleague told me that thousands of people had been killed, and it was one of the reasons why Angolans didn't go out on the streets and demonstrate, because they were still afraid. Because there's an idea in Angola that this was a demonstration, it was not an attempted coup. And there's an idea in Angola among some Angolans that it means that if you go out on the streets to protest, you will be killed, and thousands of you will be killed. And that has remained very much until very recent times the idea that people have. And that was when I started to think, you know, this is seems to me to be a major episode in the country's history that has been ignored.
What do you think is the effect of that on Angola today? I mean, part of it is to repress dissent, yeah, clearly, as you just said. But
you mean
else?
The 27th of May or the lack of work on
Well, all of it. The fact that it happened and the fact that people still are not willing to talk about it and acknowledge it.
Yeah, I think, well, the interesting thing, I mean, I think that the fact that people don't talk about it, I think that's one of the reasons why the figures have got so big, because there's almost an idea amongst those who've been involved in it or who've lost relatives that to get people's attention, they have to sort of exaggerate the figures. So it's become this sort of, in some ways, I think the fact that the ruling elite has failed to talk about it, in some ways has made it worse, because it's encouraged people to sort of make these claims that are increasingly, I think I'd say, absurd. I just don't think 80,000 people were killed. I think it's wrong. But the other thing that's so extraordinary that I found very touching and also quite disturbing is that since my book has come out, it's also been published in Portuguese. So people in Angola have been able to get hold of copies. And it's actually sold in Luanda, to my amazement and delight. And I get messages from Angolans on Facebook, for example, saying that they've just read a copy of my book, that they're normally people in their 20s or their 30s, that no one in their family has ever talked to them about this, or it might have come up in conversation and then it's immediately dismissed, and that they have never understood what it's about. And then they've read my book, or they've read the book that came out in Portuguese, and they've suddenly started to put parts of their family's history together. So they've started to understand why it is that one of their aunties went a bit mad, and no one ever talks about why she went mad. Maybe it was because her boyfriend disappeared in the uprising. Or they've discovered why their uncle, who disappeared, but no one ever talks about why he disappeared. In fact, they're now beginning to understand why he disappeared. And, you know, some of these people I interview in my book, the first woman I interview in my book, her daughter came to me in London to say she didn't know how her father had died, but she knew that he disappeared on the 27th of May. And she'd met someone who heard that there was this British woman researching the 27th of May. And she said, could it have anything to do with my father? And indeed, it did have something very much to do with her father. But I think there's a silence within families. And I mean, I'd like to kind of add at this point, I think it's really important to bear in mind that this isn't something peculiar to Angola. I recently was in Spain and I spent time with a Spanish family, friends of mine, who have family involved in the Spanish Civil War. And it's exactly the same in Spain. People's grandparents don't talk to their children and their grandchildren about what happened in the Spanish Civil War. And I think it's partly because there's a lot of shame. People are very ashamed about what went on.
The reason we know more about it today is Laura Pawson. She's a former BBC correspondent in Africa and the author of In the Name of the People, Angola's Forgotten Massacre. Laura, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
She's going to be at Duke University on October 16th to talk about the book, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton, as well as Andrew Tai. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.